on the website. Let's turn to David Charles Manners, who's a writer and designer and also a yoga teacher and, as we've said, physical therapist, working with some of the great opera companies. Also founder of the Sava Charity, looking after sufferers from leprosy in the subcontinent. But his new book, Limitless Sky, also takes in a strong sense of ancestry. It's a thoughtful and strange and often startling account of going deeper than most Westerners do into the Nepalese tradition and philosophy. They tell you not to call it a religion, don't they?
Yes, because it's not an organisation of followers. It's a philosophical path, but very practical. This has arisen amongst an extremely practical people who live in very difficult natural surroundings. Those hills have difficult weather and so forth. And it's a very ancient tradition, goes back many, many centuries. And it is a guide for life, how to live more effectively, more healthily, more joyfully.
Bit of a relief to you, I would imagine, because I know your own upbringing was heavily religious, the Mormon church. You were designed to be one of these missionaries, weren't you?
I was. My family are Mormon, four generations, and it suits them very well, which I respect. But for me, growing up, knowing from a very young age that my emotional and physical interest was in my own sex, really was a cause of great personal conflict.
They're not keen on gayness, are they?
I wouldn't recommend being Mormon and gay.
So was there a point where you had to walk away from it quite sharply?
A church court was convened when I was 20, and I was excommunicated.
This is like Oscar, isn't it? And so explain what took you to Nepal. You have a great-uncle.
Yes, my great-uncle Oscar, Hindu uncle, as he was known, was a tea planter in the northeast of India. And he was something of a childhood hero, although, of course, we never met. He died before I was born. But my grandmother had filled my head with stories of hedonistic and rather naughty Uncle Oscar. And she would tell me that he had taken local tribal wives, one being a Lepcha princess. And there were stories of his children being hidden under the floorboards when mountaineers, because his house was on the road up to Everest, and he would hide the children and his principal wife, my great aunt Isi, under the floorboards.
So the British mountaineers wouldn't get shocked?
Yes, exactly.
By this? Dear, we're all into scandal today, aren't we?
And so my first journey to India, I undertook on my own in my 20s, was first to find the places where my father grew up, and also to see if I could find anything of the truth of these family legends, because there were members of the family that tried to poo-poo them, say that it was my grandmother's overactive imagination, too much cheese at bedtime. And to my astonishment, I found that it was absolutely true and that I had 36 blood cousins living on the old family estate.
But where the core of this book really begins is that with your newfound cousin, you encounter this rather alarming figure with a necklace of skulls carved from bones and a thigh bone flute, who is a sort of shaman, a Jankri. And you very rapidly decide to become a pupil. he sounds alarming. I have to say that Jankri sounds pretty damned alarming at first.
Really? Well, he didn't seem... He seemed extraordinarily gentle. And my cousin tried to make me frightened of him by mentioning that the bones were human bones and so forth. But this man was so gentle, and his smile so genuine, and his welcome so warm, that I was intrigued. And, of course, the mystical aspect of those characters, I'd never come across anyone who claimed to be a shaman of any tradition. And so to come across this man and to have been sent to him by a peddler in the marketplace, it all seems too extraordinary to believe.
But, I mean, this is not some vague 1960s-type spiritual tourism where you sort of vogue off there and chant a bit and say this is great and put on some robes and go back home. You were willing to go through some really alarming initiations.
Over a period of time, not all at once.
Well, but it starts off quite soon where you're stark naked and having hot liquid poured over you and
Yes, well, what I didn't realise was that once the Jankri had figured me out and had, for whatever reason, decided that I might be a suitable initiate, he began serving me extraordinarily delicious spicy tea. Little did I know, and in fact it was about 24 hours later that I discovered, he was feeding me psychotropic plants, a very careful blend of things like cobra lily, sal resin from the trees, datura, cannabis, all in the teas. So when it came to him suggesting that maybe I would be interested in an initiation, I was extraordinarily willing.
You were, but I mean, these can be... I mean, we've had a death recently from somebody in another part of the world having strange initiation teas, some lad. But you were drawn... I mean, the book takes you... You're drawn absolutely into this whole sense of a different capacity for life and joy and being open to life, open to every living thing.
Yes.
It was important enough for you to go on and to go through, as I say, other initiations. I mean, blindfold in a cave for 5 days.
Yes.
With animals and snakes creeping around.
Particularly extraordinary, because what I discovered very quickly, and I've subsequently read about to try to understand the experience, is that when the optic nerve is starved of stimulation, your image-hungry brain begins to seemingly project your subconscious outwardly. So you're seeing the workings of your subconscious, the filter through which you would normally experience your everyday life.
Like the ultra-receptive people listening to Roz's commentaries.
Absolutely. Yes. And it is rather, well, for me certainly, it was really rather alarming.
Well, especially, I mean, it's a turbulent part of the world as well. I mean, there's a lot of repression by the army and so on. Bad things happen in the course of the book, you know, bad
they
political
do.
Things.
They do. It's something that seems very little reported over here, but there's been a push for independence for that part of North Bengal up against the Nepalese border since 1907. The first appeals were made to the British. And it has become increasingly violent over the last few decades. And there have been times, one of which is described in the book, when all foreigners have been expelled from the hills. And that comes at a crucial moment, actually, in the book.
But, I mean, initiations, you go through this series of initiations, as I say, including the blindfold in a cave and all the fear that you're clearly getting something important out of it for yourself all the time.
Yes. Whilst on that first journey, I hadn't gone looking for anything like that. It was purely family orientated. I was profoundly unhappy with myself. The legacy of my religious upbringing had left me in deep conflict. And even though I had always known...
And being thrown out for being gay. I mean, that's a terrible thing, to be excommunicated from a family religion if you don't like it.
I think it was more painful for my family than it was for me. It was something of a liberation. But it had left profound pain internally. But one of the extraordinary things that the Jagkri taught me over time was to recognize and name that conflict and realize the impact it had on my external life. And learning to resolve my inner self, my conscience with my outer life, was an imperative part of me learning to be able to embrace life and others and myself in ways I don't believe I could have done otherwise.
There are some wonderful descriptions of the initiations. I mean, curious one involving the doubt of the Jankri, where you find him sort of hopelessly drunk and pathetic, and you think, oh, well, he's just been another failure. But actually, what you are learning is compassion for even forgiving even your teacher for being less than he is.
Absolutely.
But the final one, spend a night next to a freshly dead body.
Yes.
Touching it, being near it all through the night. It sounds like a horror film plot. And I love the fact you admit to your Western squeamishness about this. You really didn't want to be near this body. You didn't know what it had died of apart from anything else.
No, I was invited to sit on the corpse naked. And that, for me, was the only time that I refused to do what I was asked to do. I mean, it wasn't an order. It was a suggestion.
But you had to sit touching it. And presumably, is the point of this to unite you with the idea that we're all mortal? Is that what it's all about?
It's to confront that great inevitability that we try so hard to avoid. And it provokes for me, it provoked every imaginable fear. Not only the cultural legacy, as you mentioned, our squeamishness around death, but having to face that as a reality. And where you might imagine it would be a morbid experience, when dawn eventually came, it had taught me to embrace life in a way that I couldn't possibly have imagined. I'd never been more aware of the fact that I was breathing. I mean, it sounds such a ridiculously obvious thing, but never had I realised the wonder of actually taking breath when you spend an entire night with your hands on a body that is not breathing. And I made a vow to myself that thereafter every single day would be lived more fully and more intensely than it had ever been before. Rather like with the blindfold experience, the experience of actually removing that blindfold after 5 days, never had colour been more vivid or extraordinary. And that remains a very active memory, even now,